the visits that I've had with some of you. You are a very friendly group for a group of people who probably most of you don't know each other. I think you really have a special friendliness with each other. And I told the group in my workshop that I told my new husband that my marriage was very aging because I became an instant grandmother. And I said, now I even look like one. Our topic for today is living through the hard times. And when I was first given that topic to speak on, I thought about the title for a while, and I decided that it needed to be changed from living through to living in. And I'd like to explain why. For most of us, there are hard times from one degree or another. Some, they're very few and far between, but for most of us, life is a struggle. And becomes more so at times. But there was a time in my life when life seemed too easy. There wasn't much happening. There wasn't much happening, good or bad. And then, as I told you the other night, in November of 79, after my husband had been in surgery for 3 hours, the doctor told me that he had cancer and that the outlook wasn't good. After that, Rod recuperated, and then he spent a year on chemotherapy. During that time, both of our children entered junior high, and both of them went through rather deep struggles during that time, which affected the whole family. Then in December of 1980, Rod had cancer surgery again. By the end of February of 81, when the doctor was going to put him back on chemotherapy, his blood pressure skyrocketed, his vision became involved, and they feared a stroke, so they put him back in the hospital again. And then in December of 85, after being clear of cancer for almost 5 years, Rod's left leg started to swell. Back in the hospital he went, and after tests and surgery, they discovered that it was cancer again. He had surgery in January of 86, but this time they discovered that they couldn't remove it all. There was no way that they could take it all out. And so Rod spent another year on chemotherapy, radiation, and in pain every day. Then on February 8, 1987, Rod went home to be with the Lord. From November of 79 until February of 87 is a long time to live through. And that's the point I'm trying to make. For most of us, life is not just one little capsulated problem that we can endure for a little while and then it's over and we can go on. But even in that, was that the end of the story? Was that the end of the hard times? I've been amazed at how many widows I've met at this conference. And all of you ladies know that the beginning of widowhood is the beginning of another very hard time, very difficult, very unusual time of life. So that wasn't the end of the hard time either. Then I learned how to be a widow. Then I learned how to cope with being alone. And one of the hardest things was watching my children learn to live without their dad. And there's no easy way around it. There's no certain things to think or believe, and suddenly it doesn't hurt anymore, as all of you know. So this is one of the richest lessons I learned, that I need not learn to live through the hard times as if there's something disagreeable, something distasteful, a sub-life, something that you just endure for a time. Hard times are a part of life. Very few of us are immune from them. I needed to learn to live, really live in the hard times. If I hadn't, half of my life would have been endured. Half of my life I would have been waiting for it to be over. And I especially came to be aware of this as Rod's life began to draw to a close that last year. I thought, if all I'm waiting for is for this to be over, I'm wishing Rod's life away. I'm wishing the last days and months of his life to be over because it hurts so much. I've got to learn to live one day at a time. I've got to learn to embrace what's happening today and accept that as good and right. And it's also what I learned to accept when one member of the family was struggling with problems. That this is life, real life, and we have to learn to live in it today. Life consists of happy and sad times, of easy and hard times, but one is not better than the other. Maybe easier, but even the painful and hard times are just as good and rich as the easy times and the happy times. Let's think for a few minutes about hard times. What are hard times for you? What makes you struggle? There may not be cancer or death going on in your family right now, but there are struggles. Some of Paul's hard times are listed in 2 Corinthians 11, 23 through 29, and I'm going to read that. Starting with the end of the verse, he says, I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a day and a night in the open sea. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressures of the concern for all the churches. Who is weak and I do not feel weak? Who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn? Most of us haven't experienced one of these happenings, much less all, except I was just made aware. I face daily the pressure of my concern, not for all the churches, but for the church. I'm sure all of you struggle with that daily, all the things that are going on in the church that you minister to. Then let's think about Job. We talked about Job the other night. Job was a godly man. But what did we remember last night? He lost all of his possessions. He lost all of his servants and all of his children. All that he was left with was a nagging wife and questionable friends. What are your hard times? And why are they hard? Sometimes it really helps us to understand why they're hard, because that's what makes them so unbearable. When the why is understood, then we can begin to really live during the hard times instead of just exist. One of the areas that I learned that made times hard was the area of contentment. Sometimes it's because we haven't learned to be content, and that's why we struggle. Let's turn to Philippians 4, 11 through 13. Paul says, I'm not saying this because I'm in need, for I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or want. Paul tells us that he learned to be content in plenty and want. And here he's referring to finances and food if you studied previous verses. But we need to also consider our contentment level in the area of physically. Do we become discontent when we're sick or infirmed? Do we expect to always be healthy? How about emotionally, when we're really down emotionally? Do we really struggle with that? Do we feel like we should always be on top? What about relationally? What about when relationships are going bad? Does that really drag us down? Do we expect all of our relationships to always be good? Well, in the area of emotionally, my husband of 20 years was gone, and for a while I was deeply in want emotionally. It had been awesome for me to see just what Rod had become to me over those 20 years of marriage, and I don't think most of us realize what a person means to us until we don't have them anymore. Then we begin to be aware of all the areas of our lives that they permeate, that are just so normal and natural that they're a part of. And it's only when they're gone. I noticed that when my son went off to college. I wasn't aware of all the areas of our lives that he affected until he wasn't there every day. So I was in want emotionally. But contentment isn't a floating along on a tranquil sea of not feeling. It's in the middle of the pain and struggle, accepting that that's where God has for us today, and that is life for us today. And asking Him to use it in our lives, to teach us in every situation that He takes us into. Paul said, I learned to be content. He didn't say, I became a Christian and I was content. That's what we need, is just to keep asking God to teach us. Another area that helps us, that we struggle with, is in our expectations. A lot of times we have unrealistic expectations. There is no life without trouble. And most families experience difficulties at one time or another while raising their children. Most families experience sickness at one time or another. I shouldn't say most. Every family experiences sickness at one time or another. And believe it or not, all families experience death. All people die. I heard the quip, and it's not funny, it's true. There's nobody living from the last generation. Oh yeah, we have some 100-year-old people, but there's nobody here 200. Nobody made it. Death is a part of life. So none of us, no matter what our struggles, are unique in what we've experienced. That's the way life is. Job's friend Eliphaz is the one who said, man is born to trouble as surely as sparks fly upward. And I'm not belaboring this point in a spirit of doom and gloom. This man didn't either, but he said it as realistically facing life. That's the way life is. And if we're going to live and cope with life, we have to be realistic. We have to expect these things. Ever since sin entered the world, life hasn't gone the way God intended it to go. Our bodies don't function perfectly. They get sick and diseased, they get broken, hurt, and they die. And God didn't originally intend that, but that's the way it is now. Our relationships are constantly in turmoil. God didn't intend that. Children are a prime example of sin tainting relationships. They're so fragile, so easily hurt, but they are so cruel to one another in order to build themselves up. Our emotions are weak and troubled and assaulted constantly, and God didn't originally intend that. Sin has so pervaded our lives that no area is free from its effects. Christ saved us from the penalty of sin and broke the power of mindless obedience to it, but every area of life is still deeply affected by it. So we expect it and we accept it, and then we trust God in His wisdom and power to use it for good. Not necessarily to rid us of it, but more importantly, to use it for good in every life that's affected by it. Everyone has trouble of one sort or another, and everyone dies. So to waste time and emotion and to sin in arrogance and pride, demanding to know why, is really ridiculous. These things happen to everyone. Well, how do you and how do I react to hard times? I learned there are two ways that we can react. We can either cooperate with the Lord or we can defeat the Lord. And one area Oh, excuse me. First, let's talk about Romans 8:28 in the NIV. For we know that in all things God works for the good to those who love him. In all things, it says God works for our good. But have you ever thought, does it matter how we act or react? Does that affect how much good God can do? Does God do the good in spite of us? Can he work for good when we won't cooperate? Does he overrule our will, or does how we react to hard things affect how much good he does? Can we truly defeat God in our lives as he works for good? Have you ever wondered if he'll force his good upon us? Well, one area that we can defeat or cooperate with the Lord is in the area of self-pity versus submission. How much can God teach a recalcitrant person compared to a cooperative learner? How many of you have children or worked in Sunday school and worked with a recalcitrant child and an eager learner? There is all the difference in the world, isn't there? I looked up recalcitrant just to make sure I was using it right, and Webster says it's to refuse to obey authority, custom, regulation, to be stubbornly defiant, to be hard to handle or to deal with. Probably most of us would say, no, I'm not recalcitrant. Maybe not outwardly, but what about inwardly? I have been at, I have been at times, and I know the difference in what God does in my life. Do I fight what he's doing? Do I do everything within my power to get it over with? Do I hold my breath? You know how a little child does sometimes in a tantrum? Until it's over, or do I run away from it? I try to avoid it. We talked yesterday a little bit about what our prayers are in the middle of hard things. Lord, get me out of here. Make it go away. Not use it. Make it last until you've done everything you can in my life. Or perhaps worse, am I arrogant and self-pitying? The arrogance is subtle, usually expressed by why me? Why did this happen to me? What have I done to deserve this? What I'm saying is I'm too good for this to happen to, or at least I'm not bad enough. There are more awful people than me that this is not happening to. Rather, should we not ask, why not me? Especially when we look around us and look back in history and see the horrendous things that have happened to godly people. Why shouldn't it happen to us? Why should we be exempt from the human race? Look at Paul, at Job. What did they do to deserve what happened to them? Paul walked with God. He gave his life in service to God once he became a Christian. He wrote a major portion of the New Testament. He gave up a home and family life in order to do missionary service most of his life. And as far as we know, he died in prison or in confinement. Did God protect him? Well, we've already read what God allowed to happen to him, and I'm sure that's not all of the things that he went through. What about Job? How did God describe him to Satan? He said, there is no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright. A man who fears God and shuns evil. He's a wonderful person. And then after saying this, God allowed everything but death to happen to Job. But as we look at their reaction to their problems, we see a huge difference. In Philippians 3, 7 through 12, we hear Paul's reaction to the hardship of his life. But whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them rubbish that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness that comes from God and is by faith. I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, and so somehow to attain to the resurrection from the dead. What we have just heard here is a solid, deep commitment to knowing Christ above all else. Nothing compares in importance to Paul than knowing Christ. Everything else dims in importance. And then there's Job. If you get into the book of Job and begin to study it, you begin to see self-pity. Job started unbelievably well, as we talked about the other night. His reactions were awe-inspiring. First of all, the Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, may the name of the Lord be praised. And then again he said, shall we accept good from God and not trouble? But as the misery continues, what happens? His heart is revealed. Self-pity and self-righteousness become abundant, and a very inaccurate concept of God. As I studied Job, I noticed that the longer God was silent, the longer Job suffered, the more sin in his life was revealed. And it made me realize that maybe that's why God allows some things in our lives to go on so long. Because it isn't until we really struggle, we really go down to the depths, we don't care anymore what anybody else thinks. We're no longer pretending to be a good Christian or pretending to trust the Lord, that what really is in our heart comes to the surface. And that's when God can begin to do his purifying work. Until we know what's in our hearts, God can't purify us. God can't rid us of it. The situation with Job did not improve until God began to speak to Job. Not after he brought Job out of the suffering. That's not when it improved, but while he was at the bottom of it. He was in the depths of despair. And God began to speak to him, and Job began to listen. Sometimes I don't think we listen until we get desperate enough. All Job's great boastings of bringing his case before God and showing God how wrong he was and how right Job was died when he was actually confronted with the living God. A second area that we can cooperate or defeat the Lord is in trusting the Lord versus self-reliance. The question isn't, why me? But the scriptures do give us a lot of answers to why. Not to our particular situation, but they apply across the board to all of us. Let's look at what Paul said in 2 Corinthians 1:9. He said, indeed, in our hearts we felt the sentence of death. But this happened. He gives us an answer. This happened so that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God. This happened so that he might learn to rely on God. I find that incredible. Do you remember what we read? Do you remember the things that happened to Paul? Floggings, beatings, imprisonments, starvation. And he says these things happened so that he might learn to trust God. All of this so that he might learn to rely on God. It must be a hard lesson to learn. Do you find it hard? I do. It's much easier to trust myself. It must take a long time to learn it if he had to go through all these things. But most importantly, it must be of incredible significance that we learn it because of the high price that is paid for it, the high price that Paul paid for it. Look at the price Job paid, his cattle, his servants, and most of all, his children. The book of Job is a study of a man and his friends searching for answers to the question why. But what's revealed in them as they search is arrogance, pride, and an ignorance of life, the scriptures, and God. The friends were judgmental and pompous, and as I said before, Job was self-righteous and self-pitying. And at the end of 30-some chapters, when God actually speaks, not a word about why. Not one word. What does he say? Well, God asked Job what right Job had to question him. Who was Job in relationship to the Lord? And then in Job 48, God tells Job what Job has been doing in order to get answers for his suffering. And this is something we need to pay attention to. He said, Job discredited God's justice and condemned God in order to justify himself. What does God mean like that? Well, Job had said that God was unfair. That's what we say when we say, why me? I'm not bad enough. Why should this happen to me? What have I done? He said that God was vindictive and that God was punishing him. Well, all of these things were totally wrong because, as we see from the first chapter, those were not the reasons why these things happened. I believe God allowed us to see the conversation between himself and Satan in order to help us to see that the reasons for what happens in our lives are beyond our knowing, and we just get into trouble if we try to figure out why. And fascinatingly enough, even in allowing us to see what occurred before all these tragedies took place in Job's life, God still doesn't tell us why he did it, why he allowed it to happen. He just shows us that there was a different reason than Job and his friends came up with. The problem with Job and his friends and with us is that we don't begin to know the mind of God and why he does what he does. And when we begin to say that we do or demand to know, it often leads us into sin. Elihu told Job in Job 36:21, beware of turning to evil, which you seem to prefer to affliction. I remind myself of that when I try to avoid a problem, when I try to avoid a struggle, that I might be turning to sin instead of going through the affliction that God has allowed. The evil of Job's was of pride and demanding that God account to him for his actions, questioning God's motives, that he doesn't have our best at heart, questioning God's wisdom, that he doesn't know what's best, questioning his love, that he doesn't do what's best, and questioning his creatorship and sovereignty, that he doesn't have the right to do what he chooses. Job had really not known God. That's what he discovered. He knew about God. He believed in God. He worshiped God, and he even obeyed God. But it took unbelievable suffering to really bring Job face to face with the living God, to really see God for who he was, and also to see himself in light of who God was. Our aim in this life is so often to acquire good families, good jobs, good homes, good relationships. And yet our goal in life should be God himself. When we found out Rod's cancer had returned, I asked the Lord not to make me strong, but to be strong on my behalf. I knew that I didn't know what the following days would hold, but I knew that he was able to be my strength. And I have never walked in such dependence upon the Lord or seen Isaiah 43:2 lived out, where he says, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. He didn't say if, he said when. But his presence was so real. And that's what he promises. A third area that we can really cooperate with the Lord is in accepting each and every day as his best for us, no matter what it holds. Psalm 118:24 says, "This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Trust him that he will get you through it and that he will use it in your life." The last year of Rod's life, as I consciously practiced living just for today, was a huge effort at first. I don't begin to say that this was easy. It's generic to human life to plan. And especially in America. I traveled overseas with Rod some, and in third world countries it was a good experience to me to see these people who their entire day was spent just earning enough money to eat, to live for the next day. They didn't have to plan. There was nothing to plan. They just needed to survive. But we do have plans, and we do make plans, and we do have control over one aspect of our lives or another. But the inclination was to look forward to when Rod would have recovered enough to go home, or to put things on hold until his chemotherapy was over and he was feeling better again, or then to when he was done with chemotherapy, or then to when he recovered from radiation, always looking forward to when life would be back to normal. My concept of normal. Obviously, things never became what they had been. And that last year could have been unbearable if God had not taught us to take one day at a time. Excuse me, and to accept that as good and normal life today. And this isn't a forced cheerfulness. It's not a Pollyanna attitude. It doesn't mean that there weren't tears and that there weren't hurts in some of those days. But it's an acceptance that what is happening has been allowed by God. And when we can accept and joyfully embrace that truth that every day of our lives, no matter what it holds, is from the Lord, it can become the handiwork of God in our lives. Then we can move from defeating God to cooperating with him, and we can learn to really live in the hard times. Thank you.